It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, it's summer camping season. That means campfire cooking. On this week's edition of Food Friday, a cookbook author shares her love of cooking outdoors and some favorite campfire recipes. First, there's a big gender imbalance when it comes to housework and household planning in the United States. While things may have changed a little over the years, women still end up doing a lot more of that work, even in households where both spouses work full-time outside of the home. Our next guest says couples are happier when that work is divided up more evenly, and we can learn from examples of couples that have figured out ways to keep things more equal. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you see this in your household? Does one partner do a lot more of the housework? And how about keeping tabs on all those details, especially when kids are involved? Or have you made efforts to balance things out? What worked? What didn't? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. Kate Mangino is a facilitator and gender expert who works with international nonprofits. Her new book is Equal Partners, Improving Gender Equality at Home. Kate, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, let's start with the basics here. When we've got a couple, both partners are working full time or thereabouts, and let's stick with a man and woman couple for now, though you look at different configurations. What do we know about how the housework breaks down in that kind of household?
So what the word that a lot of researchers use nowadays is neo-traditional, which is the most common couple that we see in North America right now. It's both parents or both partners do work outside of the home, do contribute to household income, but the vast majority of those household chores falls on one person over the other. And in different sex couples, the trend is that it falls on the woman, that she does about twice as much work in the home than her male partner. So if you think about quantifying that over time, if a man puts in 10 hours a week doing chores, caregiving, whatever, she's putting in 20. And over time, that really adds up to a very significant amount.
And let's talk about what we mean by work. And I'll own up to something here. A lot of times I think I used to think about just the doing of stuff. You're washing the dishes, going to get groceries or whatever. And I think we're pretty close to even, my wife and I. I know all guys probably say that, but I think we were close. But there was a whole nother category that I didn't take into account. And you talk about in your book, some people call it emotional labor or cognitive labor. I call it logistical, the planning, the keeping tabs on stuff, the agenda. And boy, if when I started mapping that out, that was very much not even. And I wasn't doing more of it. That's pretty common, right?
It's very common, and I appreciate you having that introspection and talking about that there is the doing. There are the physical tasks, and that does take a lot of time. It's unloading the dishwasher, folding the laundry, cooking food, doing grocery shopping, and that does take up a lot of time. But you're right. What I call cognitive labor, but it has lots of different terms, it's really kind of project management work. It's anticipating what needs to be done. It's looking forward. It is managing time, managing schedules, not just RSVPing to that birthday party invitation, but calling the parents of the kid whose party it is. What kind of presents do they like? Making sure you have time to stop and get that present, making sure you wrap it in time. There are all these little mini steps that happen in every process around the household. Decisions have to be made. There's always some sort of monitoring process. Did I make a good decision? Do I need to make changes in the future? And all of that cognitive labor is very exhausting, to be honest. And it's often not tracked in data, because we ask couples and research to take notes in time journals. But cognitive labor can happen when you're in the shower, when you're driving to work, when you're exercising, and we're often not capturing the hours that people spent doing cognitive labor.
You make the case that, you know, this setup isn't great for the partner who ends up doing all the work, but it's also kind of bad for the person who's not doing so much work. And when you started to look at couples where things were more evenly divided, both parties ended up being happier. Why is that?
Precisely. I think that it's easier to notice how it's harder for the woman, for the cognitive laborer. We see limitations in her professional life, in her income earning ability, in her emotional health and day-to-day happiness. But we also see that in her male partner. When men are pigeonholed into that income generation role, when they are only seen as someone who helps out in the home but really doesn't take responsibility for contributions or cognitive labor, we sort of, I would say, subconsciously push him away from caregiving roles, from emotional bonding, from having deeper relationships with children, deeper relationships with their spouse. And for research for my book, I identified and interviewed 40 men who are living as equal partners. So they meet my definition of doing half of the physical and cognitive tasks in their home. And when I interviewed them, I asked them, you know, what did you have to give up to live this way? And they very quickly corrected me and said, oh, no, I'm not giving anything up. I am living the life that I want to live because the rewards far outweigh any sacrifices. I have meaningful relationships with my family members. I don't have to act a certain way. I don't have to posture. I can be my own genuine self. And that those kind of relationships were really worth it for them. It was more important than having some extra leisure time.
Talking to Kate Mangino about her new book. It's called Equal Partners, Improving Gender Equality at Home. You can join in with your questions, maybe your experiences, at 800-642-1234. Let's go to your calls now. Mary is with us in Madison. Mary, hi. Are you there, Mary? Not hearing Mary. Let's go to Steve then in Sun Prairie. Steve, hello.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. Obviously, I haven't done extensive research, but I have a lot of male friends, and we have conversations about these types of things. And the consensus seems to be, at least with people that I know, is that men do the outside work, the back-breaking stuff, and women seem to do more of the internal stuff of the house. And the reasoning why that is a lot of the men gave up, because women have a certain way of doing things, and if the man deviates, it causes friction, as opposed to the woman being more open-minded that there might be a different way of doing things. So it's easier for the men to say, you know, I'm not going to focus on that.
Steve, thanks for the call. And Kate, this is something you heard in your research from the book. This is not just Steve and his buddies we're talking about here.
Absolutely. I'm so glad that Steve called in and raised this point. You're absolutely right. Traditionally speaking, women do indoor tasks. And they're also routine tasks, things that have to happen every single day. If you skip a day of cleaning up the kitchen or you don't feed the kids, you know about it. That's not something you can give up easily. Whereas men tend to do outside coded tasks that are intermittent. So if you do skip a weekend of mowing the lawn or you don't get the light bulb switched, you don't necessarily notice it. So male coded tasks have a bit more flexibility. And in that flexibility, there's a bit more choice and room for not just error, but room for, you know, something different, right? So if you do skip your tasks for 1 or 2 days, it's okay. Whereas female coded tasks tend to be those relentless things that have to happen every single day. And I also agree with Steve that sometimes we have this notion that there's a right way of doing things and a wrong way. I talk about this head on in my book. I realize it's an unpopular topic sometimes to bring up with women, but maternal gatekeeping is a very real thing. And this all plays back into our gender norms, which I really get into in detail in the book. And I talk about how we raise boys and girls differently. We raise them to have different values. We raise boys to value income generation, and we raise girls to value domestic work. And that very much translates into the roles that we take on as adults. And sometimes a woman, oftentimes, and I'm guilty of this as well, we value ourselves based on the level of cleanliness in our home, what kind of lunches our kids pack for school, how cute the Halloween costumes are on October 31st. And men don't feel judged for those things in the home. They kind of get a pass. So that does translate into bickering in the household about who's going to do what the quality level is, taking control. I think it's really healthy for couples to have a conversation. What do you feel like you're judged for? What do you feel like you have to do? And to see if you can mix up some of those chores a little bit. So, you know, women are stretching themselves to do more male-coded tasks and vice versa, so we don't get trapped in these patterns.
Steve, thanks for that call. And Kate, that all points to, I think, a key takeaway of your book, which is not men are lazy, am I right? It's
Absolutely
these are things
not.
Coming from a much deeper, a long-term historical place.
Absolutely. We are all survivors of gendered norms and gendered upbringing, and they're all connected to each other. What women are raised to do is directly connected to what men are raised to do. And I think it can be trapped. It feels like a trap for all of us, and it can be a little bit suffocating. Some of us are okay with our gendered roles. We're quite comfortable with it. But those of us who don't really naturally fit with what we're supposed to do with our gender identity, it can feel very limiting.
We're talking to Kate Mangino about her new book. It's called Equal Partners, Improving Gender Equality at Home. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Has this been a frustration in your house? The division of household labor, maybe between two working parents, say. What are some of the frustrations? What are some of the solutions you found along the way? If you have advice, maybe to share with others, call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We're picking up our conversation with gender expert Kate Mangino. Her new book is called Equal Partners, Improving Gender Equality at Home. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your questions about our guest research, or maybe the experience in the household you're running right now, or the one you grew up in. What did that division of labor look like? Did it cause stress? Did you find ways to work through that? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Let's go back to your calls now. Alyssa is with us in Sparta. Alyssa, hi.
Hi there. Thanks for taking my call. So my partner and I have been together for about 15 years and married for 10. He's male. He's very willing to help with things, but I have to prompt that or request that assistance with household tasks and children, et cetera. And it's like the observation is not as present with him as it is for me. So I often have to anticipate the needs. He's unable to do that. I'm just wondering if the author could speak to any research that she gathered in writing the book, if that's kind of typical of relationships.
Thanks for that call. Alyssa, I'm guessing, is very much not alone, Kate.
Alyssa is definitely not alone. I'm really thankful that you called in and shared that personal story. But what you're explaining is very much on par with what the majority of American households are experiencing in that neo-traditional relationship where one person is really sort of a manager of the home and the other person takes this helper role. And as you've experienced yourself and a lot of us have experienced in the past, being that manager is incredibly time consuming, and making a list of tasks for someone else to do is in itself work. And then of course you have to do all the follow-up to make sure that they've done the work. So, you know, I think one thing that I try to propose in my book is that we haven't reached gender equality, that this is not as good as it gets. We are absolutely in a better place than we were in the 50s and 60s. We've come a long way. But I'd like to think of ourselves right now at a milestone and not an endpoint. And I think that this helper supervisor role where we seem to get stuck right now, I'm hoping that with enough conversation and intentional work, we can continue on this pathway and in the future decades really get towards something that feels more equitable.
Alyssa, thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. Kate, I can think of all sorts of bad ways to tackle the problem of unequal division of housework. But you, the heart of your book really is those 40 people you talk to who really exemplify a more equal way of doing things. What were some of the things that struck you first and foremost about how these couples made that happen?
So it was really interesting when I learned it, when I, you know, talked about where they sort of came from. They were 40 unique stories. They were 40 men from around the United States, a few in Canada. Really didn't see too many patterns in their upbringing. Mm-hmm. A few patterns, like a quarter of them came from single mom households, but not too many unanimous stories. However, when it came to making it work now, they all had the common belief that this was best for them because they wanted to have a great, solid relationship and that this made them happy, that they liked contributing, that they wanted to be an equal partner, both to support their spouse's professional life, but also to support their spouse's emotional health. So I think that the commonality was about how they live today as opposed to where they came from. And in terms of tactics, you know, I heard lots of different ideas. Some people had weekly check-ins. Some people had monthly check-ins. Some people spoke more spontaneously. But all of them had very open communication with each other, and they really tackled the cognitive labor and made sure to divide that. Some people switched on and off. So for a year, one person would do all the feeding and the other person would do the laundry, and then they would switch so that no one felt like they were stuck doing a job they didn't want to do. There were lots of different examples. So I think there's many ways to be successful.
We're talking to Kate Mangino, author of the new book, Equal Partners, Improving Gender Equality at Home. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your household experience when it comes to how you divvy up the tasks and the planning of those tasks. Maybe some solutions you've found along the way. 800-642-1234 is the number, or email ideas@wpr.org. Kate, part of this is a mindset thing. One thing that struck me, at least one of the men you talked to, maybe more than one, took the role of the idea of a man as a provider for their family and kind of rethought that. And it might mean bring in money, but it might also mean, you know, providing that more a meal in the morning for a kid or providing a clean home. Can you talk about that sort of twist on the mindset?
Absolutely. I think we've long coded men as being the providers, right? And sometimes we think of it in an old-fashioned way of sort of bringing home a paycheck. But providing for your family can look like many different things. It could be time spent. It could be caregiving for an infant or an older family member. It could be taking care of laundry or cleaning or pets. There's lots of different ways you can provide for your family. I had a great story from a man named Jack who's up in Vermont. And his wife is a physician and made enough money for their family. And he didn't need to bring in extra income, but he had two little kids and his wife had a demanding job. And he realized what I need to do to provide for my family right now is to be present and to spend time with my kids and be the parent who is home and who's there for them. And so he took a different job that would allow him that time. So I do think that, and this is something that I think the greater community could do. This isn't just about individual nuclear households, but if all of us collectively embraced this idea that parents provide for their family in lots of different ways, and instead of coding it about what men do and what women do, just think about what parents do as a whole. Yes, we bring home income to buy physical things, and we provide time and caregiving as well.
You also, in your book, try to learn from same-sex couples who, you know, they can't just fall in naturally to the gender roles they grew up with. What kind of things can we learn from them?
So data shows us that, on a whole, same-sex couples are more equitable than different-sex couples, but still fall into this female-coded role and male-coded role. Oftentimes, especially this happens with kids because the school day is shorter than the workday. Doctors and dentists and daycare providers and camp directors ask for one parent contact, right? So one person automatically sort of has an expertise in the domestic work and one person, you know, has an expertise on income generation. But I do think that same-sex couples are on a whole sometimes more willing to try something different because they've already been forced to think through their own gender identity in the past. So, but I do think it's unfortunate and interesting that they can fall into gendered patterns even when their own gender doesn't match that role that they're exhibiting. And I think that's another important idea that these are roles. They're not connected to us biologically. They are things that we perform because of what we learn in our society and what's role modeled to us.
Let's bring on another caller now. Kay is with us in Madison. Kay, hello.
Hi. I wanted to share that when I was first married, the biggest fight that I had with my new husband was whether or not we were going to hire a cleaning lady. Because he said we weren't the kind of people to have a cleaning lady. And I said, well, I was. And anyway, he ended up liking her so much, he would buy her favorite soda and everything. And I did win that argument, I guess. But
Kate.
I didn't feel like cleaning either, so
Kate, thanks a lot. Kate, again, I think this might be a pretty common argument.
It is a common argument. I'm glad that she brought up that this happened early in her relationship. I've gotten some early feedback from readers in their, you know, in their 20s, like the younger millennials and the Gen Z who are just starting out. And they didn't, you know, they had this sort of unspoken feeling that things weren't quite balanced in their new households, but they couldn't put it into words. And they're finding this idea of cognitive labor helpful so that it's something they can talk about early in their relationships and set some boundaries for themselves. So good on you for setting a boundary about how to maybe outsource some work so that you both have equal time for leisure.
Thanks for that call. And briefly, Kate, as we wrap up, it seems like the key is to think and talk about these things, because if we don't, we're just going to fall into a pattern that may not be great.
Absolutely true. I think that that's the number one learning here is, you know, have an intentional understanding of what those gendered roles are. Think through what's been role modeled to you. What do I like? What would I like to repeat? And what are the things that I might want to change for my life and for the next generation?
Kate, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you so much for your time.
That's Kate Mangino, facilitator and gender expert. We talked to her today about her new book. It's called Equal Partners, Improving Gender Equality at Home. You can still share your stories. Email ideas@WPR.org. That's ideas@WPR.org. Coming up after the news, it's Food Friday. A cookbook author and camping pro tells us how to make delicious meals on your next camping trip. And you can share your favorite campfire recipes. You can get started right now, by the way. Head over to the Ideas Network Facebook page. Tell us about your campfire cookery favorites. And check out some recipes from our guest, WPR.org/Food Friday, to get ready for your camping trip, maybe this weekend. I'm Rob Ferret. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time here on the Ideas Network. To Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, the House Select Committee investigating the January 6th insurrection held its final hearing until September last night. We'll talk about the witness testimony around former President Trump's actions between public appearances while his supporters attacked the Capitol and where the committee goes next. Now, summer camping season is here. That means getting outside with people you love and great meals around the campfire. Not everybody's a seasoned camper or seasoned cook, and cooking over a campfire can be intimidating if you've never done it. Our Food Friday guest is a camp cooking pro. She's got advice and some recipes to help us get started. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. What memories do you have of meals around the campfire? Memories from years ago or maybe last weekend? Do you have some go-to recipes for using the campfire? Does it sound like a lot of work to you? What questions do you have? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Ashley Rodriguez is a cookbook author, writer, and photographer. She's the co-creator of the Kitchen Unnecessary series about cooking outdoors, nominated for a James Beard Award. She's a nature and forest therapy guide. Ashley, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you. I'm so excited to be here talking about something that I love so much.
What is it you love so much? Not just about camping, but about, you know, taking that effort and cooking using the campfire.
Well, no matter where I'm at, I want to be eating delicious food. And so when we started cooking and camping with our family, I wanted to kind of experiment and play around with cooking over the fire to see if I could bring that same delicious meal that I would cook at home in my kitchen and see if I could do it at the campfire and kind of elevate that food experience and go a little bit beyond, you know, the just hot dogs over the fire, or what we also love to do, which is delicious, but we wanted to kind of elevate, you know, just the potatoes and tinfoil, that kind of a thing. So I started playing around with it and bringing some more ingredients and just treating the campfire like my stove.
And I have maybe the wrong mindset here, because I came in thinking, oh, this sounds like a lot of work, a lot of trouble. no, you say, I mean, yes, it can be some work, but you actually really enjoy. You think there's something almost therapeutic, I think, about cooking around a campfire.
I absolutely do. And it is a little bit of work. And, you know, cooking is a bit of work. But the thing with cooking around the fire is that it's wild. It's a bit uncontrolled. And so it forces me to be present and to stay in the process, which is also what I love about being outside, is that it sort of just takes you out of your inbox and reprioritizes your to-do list and offers us some perspective. And cooking over the fire does that for me. I mean, we used to do that, right? This is what we knew how to do. And so it also connects to us in a way that feels really primal. There's something instinctual about cooking over the fire that I absolutely love.
When we're looking for recipes now, you shared some, we'll get to those in a bit, but in general, what are some of the keys, especially for the novice, to a successful campfire recipe?
Well, I like to have a bit of a plan. I do some of my prepping at home because, you know, it is a little bit more difficult when all you have maybe is a knife and a cutting board, if that. Maybe you're just cutting on a picnic table at the campsite. So I like to prep and plan ahead. I also, if we're going with a group, I like to kind of divvy it out. So you bring some chopped up vegetables. I might bring a dressing or some sauce that's already made ahead, so that what I'm doing is just cooking over the fire and assembling some of the things that we prepped ahead. But really, you can look at your campfire as you would an oven or a stove. There are just some things that you need to be aware of. And you also need to go into it knowing that perfection does not exist here. And that's okay. You know, I do love to bake bread over the fire. And more often than not, there's a big patch of it that's got a nice large charred spot. But there is still nothing better than homemade bread, especially when you're eating it sitting around the fire. So you have to kind of readjust your expectations, go in with a bit of a plan, and then allow for some space for creativity and, you know, allow the fire to do what it's going to do.
What are some of the key tools we want to pack along with us?
That's a great question. And I've kind of gotten this down now to a point where I just have a bin already loaded and packed and ready to go. So I have no resistance when the campfire is calling. So I keep a knife kit already packed and ready with just a very sharp knife, some long metal tongs. So this will help keep your hands free from the fire. I always have like a fireproof glove also that just, again, you're going to be very close to the fire. So you want to stay as safe as possible. I might bring a wooden spoon or a spatula, and that's pretty much it. I have, you know, some very basic seasonings. I bring a few pantry items with me, salt, pepper, some olive oil. I throw in a fresh lemon because you never know when you need a little acid in there, but I keep it really, really simple. I just went camping with a good friend of mine this weekend, and I raided my garden and just brought a ton of vegetables. We each brought a couple of cheeses and some lovely bread, and we picked up some oysters at a seafood market on the way, and grilled oysters and vegetables and cheese and bread. And we just had a delicious feast with the water as our background.
It's Food Friday. We are cooking around the campfire with Ashley Rodriguez, cookbook author, co-creator of the Kitchen Unnecessary series about cooking outdoors. You could join in at 800-642-1234. What do you like to cook around a campfire? Whether that campfire is in your backyard, at a campsite you drove up to, or maybe one you hiked a long way to get to. What are your favorite foods to eat around the campfire, fancy or simple? What questions do you have for our guest? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Ashley, you shared some recipes with us. They're online at wpr.org/foodfriday. Let's start. I think this is on the simple end here. Ember cooked cheese. Great. This is Wisconsin with rosemary ash. This is super easy and it looks super delicious. Tell us about it.
It's super easy and it sounds so fancy, right? It's literally taking a chunk of one of your favorite really nice melty cheeses, sticking it in a cast iron pan and heating it over the fire. Just to add a little bit more flavor and a little bit more excitement, I take some rosemary that I've brought from my garden, and I'll just stick it right on the coals until it gets this beautiful fragrant smoke. And that those charred leaves have a really lovely flavor. So I'll just crumble that right into the melty cheese. Invite your friends and family to head around the campfire with hunks of bread, and you just start dipping that into that melty cheese. And it is a really special experience.
What are some of your favorite cheeses to use for this?
I like I'm talking to Wisconsin here, so I just like something that is really nice and creamy and really melty. So a good cow's soft cheese that just can kind of puddle and melt. And if you're really lucky, get those crispy bits around the edges of the cast iron. That's the best part.
And now we'll advance our cast iron cookery a little bit with some pizza. We've got a pizza with mushrooms, speck, and arugula, but give us the basics. I'm guessing we're not mixing the dough and hand tossing it on the spot.
No, I actually love to bring my dough with me to the campsite. It's another one of those things. And to save some cooler space, sometimes I'll even freeze the dough and then it becomes another ice block. So I'm always trying to extend the life of my ice in my cooler. So this is a good way to do that. But I bring my dough already pre-mixed to the campsite, kind of roll it out or stretch it out by hand. This is when, if you can bring a cutting board or some kind of surface like that, it's really helpful. And then I heat my cast iron over the coals in the fire. And when it's nice and hot, I'll add a little bit of olive oil, put the dough right into the pan, let it cook for a few minutes, then carefully flip it over. And then that's when I'll add my toppings, my cheese, whatever you have on hand. If you're using some vegetables or mushrooms, things like that, you might want to saute those up a little bit first and then cook your dough and add it to the top. And it is so wonderful.
And that reminds me,
pizza around the fire, what's better than that?
It sounds great. And that reminds me of a key point here. Most of the cooking we're talking about, you're not holding a thing in the flames or over the flames. You're kind of using that bed of coals to be your heat source.
Exactly. That is such a good point. And that's something that I kind of had to figure out when I first started doing this. It's all about the coals. And so I do a lot of car camping. I'm not backpacking in with my cast iron and hardwood charcoal. Yeah. But I will often bring some hardwood charcoal to the campsite with me if your campsite allows it. But that way I can kind of preemptively get a nice hot bed of coals going. So you can start the fire with some soft wood, but then you want to get a nice bed of hardwood coals. That's going to give you the nice elongated heat source for a really long time, but that's going to help you also control the temperature, and you're really going to be cooking with that. Otherwise, you know, you might get too much flames, too much smoke, too much really hot heat on your food. And so it kind of chars before it has a chance to cook. So get a nice bed of coals. If the fire pit is big enough, my favorite thing to do is to have some of the fire, you know, there's flames over here, but then you're moving the bed of coals into your cooking section. So you kind of create two different sections. You get the section that is always getting the coals ready for you. And then once those are ready, you move them over to your cooking section.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Laura is with us in Twin Lakes. Laura, hi.
Hi. I was calling about, I'm planning a trip to Bigfoot State Park in Lake Geneva next week, and I'm going to stay overnight and then walk around Lake Geneva. And what I really love is you have a campfire the night before, and early the next morning with the embers from the coals from the night before, you take your bread and toast it. It is incredible. You have to watch it very carefully, but you can make the most spectacular toast early in the morning with those coals left over.
Laura, thanks. Oh, go ahead.
That's one of the things I have to look forward to.
That's wonderful, Laura. Mm-hmm. Thanks a lot. You know, I think I could pull off campfire toast, Ashley, even me.
Oh, absolutely. It's that, and that's such a great idea. That's exactly what we had for breakfast on our camping trip this weekend. Brought some homemade jam, and really, is there anything better than that?
Thanks for that call, Laura. We're talking to Ashley Rodriguez. She's a cookbook author, co-creator of the Kitchen Unnecessary series about cooking outdoors. She's with us on Food Friday during summer camping season to talk about meals you can make on and around the campfire. And you could join in at 800-642-1234. What are your favorite foods to eat cooked on or near the campfire? Advanced or simple? 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation, maybe hear from you coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our Food Friday talk about meals you can make on your next camping trip. Ashley Rodriguez with Kitchen Unnecessary stays with us, and you could join in at 800-642-1234 with your memories, your questions, your favorite things to cook at the campfire. 800-642-1234 is the number. Let's go back to your calls. Tim is with us in Minnesota. Tim, hi.
Hey, I had two questions for Ashley. One was about how if you have to cook multiple foods at different temperatures, how you kind of manage that on the fire. And then the other question, Ashley, I was wondering if you've ever done any experimenting with cooking underground, like using coals or a fire, and then just using, I guess, using the dirt in the ground to kind of insulate and cook your food.
Oh, wow. Okay, two great questions, Tim. Thanks. First of all, when we need to cook things at two different temperatures, that can be a problem in the oven at home, too.
Yeah, absolutely. These are great questions. Thanks so much, Tim. Yeah, so again, like I said, with, you know, if you have a big enough space, a big enough campfire, you can kind of create zones. And again, you're using the heat of the coals to adjust the temperature. So if you need things at different temperatures, you can have a spot that has a larger pile of coals. Maybe it has a bed underneath the pan and surrounding the pan. If you're using a Dutch oven, you're also using the heat of the coals on top of the lid. And then if you need something to cook a little bit slower, then you just move away some of those coals. Maybe don't have any on the bottom of the pan, but just a couple that are a couple of inches away from the sides of it. So it's all about manipulating and moving around those coals that will control the heat for you. And as far as cooking things underground, that is something that I think it's such an absolutely cool technique. I've seen, you know, those just giant succulent pigs and things that they cook underground. And I think that is so cool. I have not done that, but I have done some like slow roasted beets under a bed of coals. And oh my gosh, ooh, a beet cooked in the fire. I promise you, it is a thing of beauty. So I've played around with some root vegetables, but that is one thing that I want to experiment with more.
Thanks for the call, Tim. John joins us now in Baldwin. Hi, John. John, hi, you're on the air. Go ahead. Oh, I guess. Go ahead. All right. Not getting John. Let's try Jackie now in Milwaukee. Jackie, hi.
Hi. What I really like is I take a loaf of crusty Italian bread with sesame seeds, four rolls, and I slice it in half, and I layer cheddar cheese and then the diced green chilies from a can, and then pepper jack cheese, put it together, tin foil, stick it on the fire about 10 minutes. It is heavenly.
Awesome, Jackie. That sounds great. And again, pretty easy, Ashley.
That sounds amazing. I'm going to write that down and save that for my next camping trip. Yeah, that sounds easy and so delicious.
And tin foil can definitely be a campfire cook's, or aluminum foil, I guess, technically, a campfire cook's best friend.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I mentioned earlier in the program, you know, that the kind of classic, what we used to call spit and chew. I know, I'm not sure if you're familiar with that, but, you know, we used to do this as kids, just throw in a couple of carrots, potatoes, things like that. But I've elevated that a little bit and threw in some sausage, some apples and potatoes, some nice fresh herbs, salt, pepper, slowly cook that. And then right while it's still warm, throw in pieces of Gruyere cheese and serve it with some Dijon mustard or even a little mayonnaise and Dijon mustard. And it is delicious.
Thanks for that suggestion at 800-642-1234. Doug is with us now in Colfax. Doug, hello.
Hello. A couple of things that we do that we really like is to pre-mix scrambled eggs for breakfast. Put them in a container and, you know, already have veggies or whatever you want to put in with your scrambled eggs. And then you just dump it straight into the pan in a nice resealable container and you got a pretty quick breakfast.
Awesome, Doug. Thanks a lot for that. Ashley, any advice on egg cooking around the campfire?
No, that sounds like a great idea. Yeah, we like to do some eggs in the morning as well. Throw on some bacon. And yeah, that sounds great. I'm going to try that next time as well.
Doug, thanks for calling in at 800-642-1234. Ashley Rodriguez is with us for Food Friday, cookbook author, co-creator of the Kitchen Unnecessary series, talking about cooking around the campfire. Let's check out another recipe you shared with us, Ashley. It's at WPR.org/Food Friday. We'll get a little fancier here. Smoked clam carbonara. Wow. That sounds to me pretty ambitious, is it?
It is not. It does sound ambitious, but pasta over the fire is also really, really good. You want to make sure that for this, you bring a steel or stainless steel pot with you to boil the water in, but the clams just slowly cook in the fire, and that's what gives them that nice smoky flavor. And then it's really just a little bit of cheese and you're making a sauce with some whipped up egg and cheese, and the heat from the pasta creates this really lovely sauce. The other thing that we like to do is campfire mac and cheese. And that you just start by sauteing some onions, or I love mushroom mac and cheese, and saute that in. Throw in your pasta into that pot and then cook it with the water in there. And then once the water is almost all absorbed and the pasta is still al dente, start stirring in your cheese. And it is so creamy and so satisfying. And that is a perfect recipe to make for a crowd.
Let's go back to our callers now. Andrew is with us in Minnesota. Andrew, hello.
Yeah, hey, how's everybody doing?
Good. What do you got for us, Andrew?
Yeah, so it can be cooked on a grill. Bruschetta, super simple. Take whatever bread you like, slice it, toast it on the fire so you get the extra points from the smokiness there as far as flavor is concerned. After it is toasted, you take a raw clove of garlic. You use the bread to grate the garlic onto the bread. So you're just talking about just a little bit. Otherwise, you can get fairly garlicky. Tomatoes, onions, basil all travels real well in a cooler. Chop that all fresh. Put that onto your now garlic toast that is smoky from the campfire, and you are promised a very good time.
Andrew, thanks a lot. Bruschetta, basically, on the campfire. I love it.
Yeah, it sounds like I got some new friends to go camping with. This sounds delicious.
Definitely. Now, Ashley, getting a little more advanced here, we got one more recipe to share here. Ooh, this one sounds good too. Roasted pumpkin fondue with chanterelles, those mushrooms, and chorizo. Now, we grow good pumpkins here in Wisconsin, and we can get some good mushrooms too.
Yeah, this is perfect. This one is over the top, but I'm telling you, you got to try it once. So, I mean, you could do just fondue over the campfire. And we mentioned that with that block of cheese, and you could just melt it that way. But this turns the vessel that you're cooking the fondue into it's edible as well. And so you start by roasting the pumpkin in the coals themselves. And then when that starts to get tender, then you turn that into the cooking vessel. You add a little white wine, throw in some cheese until it's nice and melty. And then in another pot, you saute up some mushrooms, chorizo, add that to the melty cheese. And again, you are just sitting around the fire, dipping bread into melty, mushroomy, pumpkin-y cheese. And especially in the fall when it's just starting to kind of get cool in the evenings. Oh, this is really an amazing meal.
That sounds great. Again, find that at WPR.org/Food Friday. Ashley, you know, one thing that's striking me, cast iron skillets, you know, sometimes we have trouble maintaining them in the comfort of our own kitchen. How do you keep your cast iron skillet, you know, clean and not having, you know, globs of cheese forever burned onto it?
Yeah, well, I've been working on seasoning mine for a number of years now, so she's been treating me well. But here's the other thing. If you are the campfire cook, then you shouldn't be doing the dishes. So we've got it worked out. So when we go camping, I'll do the cooking, but I'm not going to be doing the dishes. So I let other people deal with that.
That sounds great. What are you, now you mentioned you just had a camping trip. I imagine you've got maybe more in the works. What is in your head for like, okay, you want to experiment with this around a campfire sometime?
Yeah, well, one thing I just did recently that was so wonderful is just really simple grilled oysters. And I brought with me a compound butter. I mixed butter with minced shallots, some hot sauce, some red wine vinegar, and plenty of cracked black pepper. And once the oysters popped open, I took off one of the shells, put some of that butter in, and grilled it until it was all bubbly and delicious. The other thing that I want to try is want to go out and get some fresh crab. We live right here by the water, and do some fire cooked crab over the fire while we're camping. I think that would be really delicious as well.
Sounds fantastic. Ashley, thanks again for joining us.
Thank you so much. This has been so fun, and now I'm hungry.
Me too. That's Ashley Rodriguez, cookbook author, photographer, co-creator of the Kitchen Unnecessary series. Join us on Food Friday for some campfire cooking. Find those recipes again at WPR.org/Food Friday.